to me with questions about today's program or get updates and fresh news, photos, and videos throughout the week, just click over to my Music Time in Africa YouTube channel, my Facebook page or Facebook group, Instagram at MTIA Maxwell, and Twitter at Music Time Africa. On our FM stations, we're live Saturday and Sunday at 1505 and 20500 UTC. We're also on shortwave radio Friday at 0905 UTC, and then again Saturdays and Sundays at 0905, 1505, 2005, and 22500 UTC. Finally, you can always find us online at voanews.com anytime. Just search for me, Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. Till next week, stay blessed, Africa. Stay beautiful.
This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. U.S. President Donald Trump met with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Sunday at the G7 summit, pledging that the two sides can quickly achieve a major trade deal. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
Donald Trump heaped praise on his British counterpart on Sunday.
You know, this is, as everybody knows, it's going to be a fantastic prime minister, I can tell you.
And told Prime Minister Boris Johnson that they'll quickly have a major trade deal.
We're talking about many different deals, but we're having a good time. As far as UK and the United States, we're working on a very big trade deal, and I think it's going to work out very well.
At a trade-focused bilateral meeting at the G7 summit in Biarritz, France, Johnson was keen to talk up the benefits of a US-UK deal. But in Johnson's G7 debut, he has a delicate task of not angering Trump whilst also keeping European leaders, who he's trying to convince to renegotiate the UK's exit from the EU, on side.
That is Reuters' David Doyle reporting. In Hong Kong, police are skirmishing with protesters for a second straight day on Sunday. While a large crowd rallied in a nearby park, another group of protesters took over a main street, building barricades with traffic barriers and cones. Police used tear gas to try to disperse the crowd. Protesters responded by throwing bricks and other objects toward the police. The Taliban says it expects to finalize a peace deal with the United States to end the 18-year-old war in Afghanistan soon. A Taliban spokesman told VOA the two sides are working on a mechanism for U.S.-led foreign troops to withdraw from the country. Taliban officials say the deal will require the insurgent group to open a peace process with Afghan officials to discuss a ceasefire. U.S. officials say the Taliban will be bound to prevent al-Qaeda from establishing a safe haven and to help defeat the Islamic State terrorists. From Washington, this is VOA News. Israel says it attacked Iranian targets in Syria to foil an imminent attack. Despite Iranian denials of the attack, the incident has sparked new tensions between Israel and Iran. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
It's rare that Israel takes responsibility for airstrikes on Iranian targets in Syria, although Israel is believed to have carried out hundreds of these attacks over the past few years. But this time, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu took credit in a tweet that praised the Army's major operational effort and said that Iran had planned to send killer drones with explosives into Israel. He warned Iran that it had no immunity anywhere. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported that five people were killed, including two fighters from the pro-Iranian Lebanese Hezbollah organization. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
North Korea says it has test-fired a new type of rocket launcher. AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
The North says leader Kim Jong-un supervised the trial of a super-large multiple rocket launcher, another demonstration of the North's strategy ahead of a possible resumption of nuclear talks with the U.S. The North's official Korean Central News Agency, or KCNA, said that Saturday's weapons test was successful and cited Kim as saying the rocket launcher is indeed a great weapon. Kim has underscored the need to continue to step up the development of Korean-style tactical weapons for resolutely frustrating ever-mounting military threats. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
A former Republican congressman is launching a challenge to President Trump for the 2020 Republican presidential nomination. AP's Tim McGuire has more.
Conservative radio host and former Republican Congressman Joe Walsh says he's running against President Trump because he fears what would happen should Trump win a second term.
I think the country can survive Trump's four-year tantrum, But you give this guy another 4 years in the White House?
Walsh tells ABC This Week that Trump is unfit.
He's nuts. He's erratic. He's cruel. He stokes bigotry. He's incompetent.
The radio host, who served one term in the House, joins former Massachusetts Governor William Weld as Republican challengers to the president. Tim McGuire, Washington.
Brazilian troops are heading to the Amazon to fight fires that have swept the region. Brazil's defense minister says 44,000 troops will be available for unprecedented operations to put out the fires. And forces are heading to six Brazilian states that asked for federal help. For the latest news whenever you want it, please visit us at voanews.com and download the VOA mobile app. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
And welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We Malawi is a democracy without the rule of law and the respect of the judiciary, then it's not democracy. We cannot either into jungle law where everybody can point out on somebody to say you are wrong, you have to be killed, you are wrong, you have to be dismissed.
Malawian Homeland Security Minister issues a warning to protesters.
From our own analysis, we think they can stretch their legs a little bit longer and can go up to something like 2,000. At least that way, they put us slightly closer to what we're looking for.
Zimbabwean public sector workers rejected the government's pay increase offer over rising cost of living.
The government in Uganda has moved so fast in clamping down on media freedom, and now it's also moving now to the non-governmental organizations that are associated in one way or another to members of political opposition that are very popular.
And Amnesty International expresses concern about the clampdown on the media and NGOs in Tanzania and Uganda. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. French President Emmanuel Macron, Femi Adesina, president of the African Development Bank, and popular African musician Angélique Kidjo launched a new $300 million initiative at the ongoing G7 summit in France Sunday. The initiative is aimed to significantly boost access to credit for businesses of African women across the continent over a five-year period. It followed discussions between President Macron and Ms. Kidjo last year. I reached Angélique Kidjo at the ongoing G7 summit in Biarritz, France, to learn more about the Access to Credit initiative for African women businesses.
I mean, the genesis of this initiative started after the commemoration of the 100th year of the First World War, November last year, with the conversation that followed with President Macron between both of us, where I expressed to President Macron that in order for us to reduce poverty, to put our children to school, and to build a future for the youth of Africa, for them not to be dying in the Mediterranean, we need the women of the market to get access to credit. That the bank are not really friendly towards the women because they have no collateral. And then he said to me, that is something that we have to change, and I need concrete. That's when the lady there contacted the African Development Bank, and we put this initiative together that we're going to launch today.
Launching this program, which is approximately $300 million, how significant is this to the women across Africa and for you to be the voice of women to carry this initiative along?
I mean, African women are the backbone of that continent. Think about this number. Every year, we lose $2.5 trillion that those women can invest if they have access to credit, which means if you have that money working in the hands of the women, they create jobs, small, medium, and big enterprises. I mean, Africa is the place where you have more female entrepreneurs. Yet, the access to credit is so, the rate of it is so high that it's not acceptable. For me, it's all about how can we African people be the one that decide what our life is going to be, to call the shot on the future of our children. How many mothers sit around seeing their children dying out of access because there's no purpose of future in Africa? And nobody's going to do nothing. I don't think the politicians have any power against that. Why can't the mother be the one in charge of that by investing and making their countries, their communities attractive to the boys and girls of Africa, for them to see that the potential of creating and being somebody in their country is doable and is possible.
Now, so how will this money be disbursed or shared among the entrepreneurs, and what criteria will be used for these women to access it?
This initiative is going to be rolled out at the end of 2020, where basically the money that has been going to be given by the G7 is going to serve as a guarantee. And we're going to have the African Guarantee Bank that will back the loan that we're going to give to women, because if they don't have collateral, you can't have a loan. Women don't have access to land, and the law also of heritage have to change also. So those women that are in the market that are considered not bankable, we have a guarantee from the African Development Bank to guarantee that if those women don't pay, the African Guarantee Bank will pay the loan. And it allows the women to really take time, and the weight is based on the needs, actually. I'm here as the genesis of this project, but also I'm here because I want to hold the African Development Bank and the President Macron accountable if this is not rolled out quickly and efficiently. That's my role.
So tell me, what are your expectations of this initiative? What do you see as the prospect?
I want the women of Africa, no matter where they come from, rural area, cities that have ideas, women are entrepreneurs at the core of it. So any woman that comes to the bank, any bank that comes into this system that we are putting together, have to be able to be received without a meeting plan. We have to make this available for women to break the cycle of poverty and inequality, because women are the forefront of all this. We are the one home that juggle with budget, that put food on the table, that does all those things. Women have to be treated and taken seriously. That's what I want to see. I want to see the transformation of those women that have wonderful ideas, to see their idea implemented, for them to create jobs. I want the young kid of Africa, the future of Africa, not to think that the only way they can have a future is to die at sea. And the mothers are the ones that suffer the most. And by giving them access to credit, they will create jobs for boys and girls. They will put their kids in school. We're gonna start into teaching financial literacy to boys and girls, especially to women. Then we have to change the leadership in banking, and we have to change the leadership in many different sectors. Women have different way of investing. I want to see my continent, we Africans, come up with solutions.
Angélique Kidjo is a popular African musician. She spoke with me from Biarritz, France. Malawian's Homeland Security Minister has declared sensitive government institutions out of bounds for protesters. Nicholas Dawsey says it will be an offense for demonstrators to protest in designated sensitive places, including airports, border posts, the Reserve Bank, and the National Oil Company. His declaration comes as protesters plan to demonstrate and hold vigils at airports and border posts to press their demands for the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission to step down. Homeland Security Minister Nicholas Dawsey tells me it will be treasonous for the protesters to defy the warning to embark on their planned protest in designated sensitive places.
We are saying that closing borders, airports, is not within the laws of the country. The Minister of Homeland Security is responsible and has powers under Penal Code to, under the Preservation of Public Security Act, to order that nobody should dare to stop those that want to enter and exit the country. So closing borders, closing the airport, is tantamount to war, and that is treasonous. On demonstration, the High Court has given an injunction restraining anybody from doing so, but even if they had to do so, That was extremely an act of aggression.
Opposition leader Chakwera is saying that coming up with such measures is contrary to the laws of Malawi and that you should go through parliament to enact such laws and that you are enacting such laws under the whims and caprices of the government, which is illegal, he says. How do you respond to that?
Well, Chakwera, he has got to read. Sometimes it helps to read. He has not read the Penal Code. Maybe he must be helped by local minds. I don't have to go to parliament. These are orders under Preservation of Public Security Act, and the Minister of Home Affairs has powers to do so. As regards to Honorable Chakwera, he doesn't know, maybe because he has never been a cabinet minister, he has never been in MC for some time. This Preservation of Public Security was enacted some time back, and it helps to read. So out of his ignorance, he can say a lot of political tantrums that result into careless statements. But we are going to make sure that this country is safe and everyone gets in and get out, and that prison, reserve bank, national oil reserves should not be a place where anybody can step his foot there.
Some are saying the government has failed to protect life and property because of some of these demonstrations that seem to have turned violent, and that some people who appear to be critics of the government are being attacked, their houses are being attacked, and their lives are being put in danger. How do you respond to such critics?
Well, the government has a constitutional responsibility in the democracy to protect every citizen. In any case, we have to make sure that every citizen, whether it's opposition or ruling, every citizen of the country has the right to safety, security, care, and custody. So we are going to do that. I must confess, there has been some staged arson, staged managed to create sympathy. Some of them genuinely legitimate arson and looting and burning of properties. So that is what we're looking into, and we'll make sure that it ends.
Some people are saying that the demand of those protesters is simply that the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission should resign because they have lost confidence in their ability to organize credible future elections. Mr. Dawusi, is the government going to engage some of these protesters? Because they said the protests will only stop after the chairperson of the Electoral Commission is either booted out or she resigns. What is the government's stance on that?
First of all, can you help us, Nadi, help the people that are funding these demonstrators to stop funding them? I don't want to mention them, but there are a lot of people, some of them, their parent companies there in the U.S. who are funding these demonstrators to cause mayhem and confusion. And secondly, Malawi is a democracy without the rule of law and the respect of the judiciary, then it's not democracy. We cannot enter into jungle law where everybody can point out on somebody to say you are wrong, you have to be killed, you are wrong, you have to be dismissed. The elections case is the court of law. Let's trust our court to determine what happened. And if the court finds that whether the election is managed or were well managed, then it's up to the court to do so. Do you believe that we should disregard the courts, disregard the law, and that everybody can wake up in the name of civil society organization, self-appointed, holier than thou leaders, and say, no, we want somebody to resign just because you people out there, you're funding. It's not fair. We're not going to do that.
Nicholas Dawusi is the Malawian Homeland Security Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Zimbabwean public sector workers have rejected a pay increase offer from the government, saying it fell short of their demands. The workers are demanding $452 for the lowest paid worker, while the government offered $97, an increase from the previous $55. The workers rejected the offer, saying the administration failed to significantly improve the offer to meet their demands. Sifiso Ndlovu, the chief executive officer of the Zimbabwean Teachers Association, tells me public sector workers expect the government to improve its offer in talks scheduled for Tuesday.
The offer that we have received from government is seriously inadequate. And what has come up is that during the negotiation period, we failed to agree with government on the rate of inflation, one, and secondly, at what level they were likely going to pay the civil servants. based on what we thought was the best level for a bottom line, that is the poverty bottom line. And that is the basis of our rejection. Because we believe from our empirical research, the appropriate and the correct level should be something like 4,600 Zimbabwean dollars as the amount that can be paid to the lowest serving worker. But then government suggested 1,023, indicating first of all that it is constrained, yes, and also indicating that it was not in agreement with our figures because they did not come from the official statistics office.
Sifiso, some people are expressing concern that the government is broke, and everybody knows that the prevailing economic conditions makes it extremely difficult for the government to meet your demands. How do you respond to that?
Yes, we have accommodated that in our analysis of what they have offered. And from our own analysis, we think they can stretch their legs a little bit longer and can go up to something like 2,000. At least that way, they'll put us a slightly submerged, though, slightly closer to what we're looking for, at least if they moved. But unfortunately, their movement is so insignificant that it does not impact meaningfully on our condition and state of subsistence.
After rejecting this offer, what is next in store in this dialogue to meet your demands from the government?
This is the first dialogue of the discussions. And we are saying now, on Tuesday, they come back. They must come up with a revision. And that revision to us is very important because it will inform to what level we can either accept or reject their offer.
Critics of yours are saying that you are not negotiating in good faith, since you are aware from your own findings and research that the public servant salary bill eats up close to 90% of the government tax revenue. So you don't pretty much give the government a room to operate to meet your demands. Your take on that?
Unfortunately, we are also victims of the economic vicissitudes in the country, where we find we cannot escape the challenges that come up with the continuous rise of prices of basic commodities and services. If that had been correctly put, then the market fundamentals would be taking control because there would be very little money chasing those commodities. Then the prices would come down. But seemingly, the prices continue to run away despite the indications. Then that means there are some fundamentals which are not placed correctly, which are affecting all of us, government and ourselves included. And the best way forward, therefore, would be if they are identified, they must be addressed. But if they are not addressed, we will continuously be pushing the back onto each other and blaming one another on the basis of what we are experiencing from different angles, though. Therefore, the issue of goodwill in us in negotiating is there. That is why we continue to go back to the negotiating table. Otherwise, if we were negotiating in bad faith, we would eventually throw everything and even throw the cat into the pigeons. And that would cause a lot of pandemonium in the system.
Sifiso Ndlovu is the chief executive officer of the Zimbabwean Teachers Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. An Amnesty International researcher says there appears to be a trend of intimidation and harassment of journalists critical of the Tanzanian government. Roland Iboli also says Uganda has deployed a similar strategy to clamp down on the media as well as on non-governmental organizations. His remarks came after the Tanzanian government arrested and charged a journalist with spreading false information. Meanwhile, the Ugandan government has also cancelled the licenses of NGOs it accuses of financially supporting opposition parties. Iboli tells me East African countries appear to be learning bad habits from each other with measures to clamp down on the media, the opposition and the NGOs ahead of their respective next elections.
The law is not very new. It's a 2016 Act, the Cyber Crime Act. But again, what Amnesty sees this as, it is that is as intimidation and harassment to journalists, and especially journalists that are critical of the government. and we are seeing a trend since in a span of 1 month. This is the second journalist that has been arbitrarily arrested and maybe charged in court over seditious and false and news claims.
Does Amnesty see this as a way to clamp down on dissent or to muzzle the press, because the constitution in Tanzania guarantees freedom of speech?
Yes, the constitution in Tanzania guarantees freedom of speech, and Tanzania is party to international treaties such as the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights. And media freedom since 2015 especially has really deteriorated with the enactment of the Media Services Act and the cybercrime and the online content regulations that all play a role in trying to muzzle media outlets in Tanzania. And it is part of a larger muzzle of dissenting voices, considering that this is not only happening to journalists, it's also happening to bloggers, the political opposition. It is happening to non-governmental organizations. So this is part of a larger kind of approach by government ahead of next year's general election.
Is this the same case happening in neighboring Uganda, where we understand the government has refused to renew or has redrawn 13 licenses of NGOs, where in some cases journalists are also warned and intimidated, allegedly by state security agencies? Is it the same kind of a situation?
Yes, it is actually the same kind of situation. And I think the region is really borrowing, countries in the region are borrowing bad practices from each other, whereby for Uganda, you have 13 organizations whose licenses have been cancelled. That means it's not even a process. It is only a situation whereby the government has not renewed. It is cancelling the licenses. And some of the reasons that have been given for cancelling these licenses are that these organizations have been channeling money to opposition member of parliament, Robert Chagulani. You remember Robert Chagulani, who's also known by his stage name as Bobi Wine, with predicament and issues that he had to go through last year, especially after the incidences where he was allegedly tortured. So we find that the government in Uganda has moved so fast in clamping down on media freedoms, and now it's also moving now to the non-governmental organizations that it deems are associated in one way or another to members of political opposition that are very popular.
Some critics suggest that these two governments appear to be going after those they see as a threat to their leadership and to their continued stay in power, hence new measures to clamp down on them. Is this how Amnesty International sees these actions being taken by both Tanzania and neighboring Uganda?
I would say that somehow within the region, this has happened and keeps on happening before, whereby any time election years approach, then you find that governments that would want to keep power or would want to retain, their leadership would now start looking at those organizations that may work against that. So you find that for Tanzania, they're going through a local election. This is more of a ward election in October this year. Of course, that is not as huge as, the general election, but still there is a. Then you will have the government of Uganda through elections in 2021. So you find that this situation causes these governments to act in the manner in which they are acting, and the most important or the institutions that are really influential is the media, and the media is seen as a threat. And this is the time that only media organizations that are closely linked to the government or NGOs that are closely linked to the government, we call them GONGOs, government NGOs, are the ones that are allowed to flourish.
Roland Ebole is an Amnesty International researcher on Uganda and Kenya. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
A team of Cameroonian entrepreneurs has created a mobile application that helps farmers detect crop disease. The app also proposes treatment and offers prevention measures. In Benguela, Cameroon, Anne Nzonke has this report narrated for VOA by Moki Edwin Kenzeka.
It has become a ritual. Every time he visits his farm, Alain Letbu uses an app to monitor the health of his tomatoes. It detects crop disease and suggests treatments and prevention measures. With it, Letbu says he spends less and produces more.
Cette application change énormément dans la production.
Letbu now uses an app called Agrix. Using the app is simple. The user focuses the phone's camera on a leaf or fruit. The application analyzes the image and gives the results within a few seconds. Agrix co-founder Dorothee Mvondo says the app is still in development but has already been tested by hundreds of farmers.
Agrix ayant détecté la maladie propose.
Joseph Mpo is an agronomist and trainer at the School of Agriculture of Benguela, a state agricultural school. He's tested the app and says it's promising, although some improvements are still needed. Mvondo says the plan is to roll out the app across Africa beginning in 2020. She trained at the State Institute of Agricultural Research for Development. Now she hopes the app will give farmers real solutions and options, since the pesticides sold in the shops are mostly chemical. The potential impact of such an app could be significant, she says. According to the Center for Agriculture and Biosciences International, farmers in Africa lose an estimated 49% of expected total crop yield per year, the highest rate of crop loss in the world. For Anne Zwanke in Benguela, Cameroon, Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, the government of Uganda has signed four agreements with Ethiopia aimed at enhancing cooperation between the two countries. They include a waiver of visa requirements for holders of diplomatic and official passports between the two countries and a memo of understanding in cooperation in correctional and prison service. They also provide for cooperation in legal assistance on criminal matters and an agreement of extradition. For VOA, Mugimi Davis Rakarinji has more from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
The study was conducted between March and July 2019 in 13 districts of Uganda. Jobo Kija, the lead researcher, read out the findings at a conference in Kampala. He says 450 people were asked about their anticipations on the 2021 elections. Kija says about 90% of those interviewed said they fear the elections could turn out to be violent for various reasons.
These include the lack of electoral reforms, which has been consistent, I think, in all the observer mission reports since 2006. There's been a recommendation that the election management system has to be reformed. The other is the engagement of security agencies in partisan politics, which has continued even after the 2016 elections. The other is tribal issues that have not been resolved.
Respondents were drawn from the ruling National Resistance Movement Party, opposition parties, elected officials, security officers, civil activists, and journalists. Jack Asimwe works for NGO Democratic Engagement and Action, which commissioned the survey. Asimwe says the electorate no longer trusts the electoral commission. She also says politicians fuel violence among young people, a majority of who are unemployed.
Election season is seen as the way that some of these young people can also cash in on, especially on violence. And so again and again, they are used as part of the violence machinery, which is a very sad thing and very irresponsible in my view.
Opposition politician Alice Alasso, the Secretary General of the Alliance for National Transformation Political Party, described the report as very candid.
It has highlighted seriously the signals, the signs that are a recipe for a violent election. And even now we can see the 2016 election, the greatest perpetrators of violence were state institutions, the army, the police, the crime preventers or crime promoters. Now they have created a new outfit to replace the crime preventers called the LDUs.
LDU stands for Local Defense Unit. In a wave of rampant crimes in Kampala and neighboring areas, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni suggested a creation of local police, commonly known as LDU, to protect people and property. Ruling party politician Lydia Wanyoto agrees that politicians help in fueling violence, but she says the government is committed to ensuring there is peace in the country during and after elections.
Parliament has young people. It's just a question of mindset. They can reorganize and bring sanity to our country and check what people are fearing to be saying. There is going to be violence. There is not going to be violence if we choose to. But if you are going to have rowdy people in the streets, government has institutions, Uganda is still running with government, they will be checked.
The research suggested there should be accountability and punishment of those who violate electoral laws. It also suggests citizens to be well sensitized of electoral laws and policies. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinjini, Kampala, Uganda.
In a population count which started Saturday, Kenya becomes the first African country to recognize people who identify their gender as intersex. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, the third category will be listed along with the male and female on census forms.
During the census, people like 52-year-old Judith Baraza will be allowed to identify as intersex. Baraza says he's happy about the initiative, but wants any details about people like him to remain confidential.
You're around 15 years.
Baraza said a request from the census people, when they get our information, to keep it secret. They should not make it public. If they can keep our information secret, I think census will be something good for us. Baraza was reared as a girl, but growing up, felt more like a boy. He says a decision by his mother has impacted him to this day. Baraza says that when he was 15 years old, his mother told him he was born with both genitals. He says she took him to a doctor who carried out surgery to remove the male genitalia. Baraza says he asked his mother why she did that to him. She said she didn't want to see him with other people like that. Kwamboka Kibagendi also identifies himself as intersex. He said, when I heard that intersex people will be included in this year's census, I was so delighted. A small survey was done, didn't establish how many people are intersex because people are afraid to come out. Now, since it is the government initiative, it will be easy even for parents to bring their intersex child out for the count. It is a plus for people like us. I am so happy. Intersex people have reproductive organs, genitals and hormones that do not fit the usual female and male characteristics. Vivian Nyarunda is a population statistician at the Kenya National Bureau of Statistics, which is tasked to carry out the census. She says it is the time to acknowledge such people in society by establishing how many identify in this way for planning purposes.
We've been categorizing as male-female, but you realize that we've been leaving them out. We need to plan for them. We need to have schools that are, you know, have their interest at heart. So we need to know how many they are so that if anything is going to be planned for, we have something that is particular for that particular group of individuals.
Human rights organizations have been calling on intersex people to come out and be counted, but many people who identify in this way have raised security and safety concerns. Rebecca Ogembo works with Nyarwek Network, an organization fighting for the rights of intersex people in Western Kenya.
This will be a matter of disclosure, and when disclosure happens, the intersex person will feel at risk, will feel vulnerable, will feel, the discrimination may be heightened at a certain point. So we are hoping that we have mechanisms that I hope the state has mechanisms to deal with that situation.
The government has vowed to take action against any officials who share people's personal information. Mohammed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Liverpool Football Club, the current European champions, have launched a new international academy in Mauritius. The academy launched on Friday aims to bring Liverpool coaching to young fans around the world, according to a press release by the club. The academy was launched in partnership with the country's sports and youth ministry. This is the second such Liverpool academy in Africa. The first was launched in Egypt, where the club will aim to deliver ongoing coaching programs to youngsters on the Indian Ocean island. The Mauritius Prime Minister started negotiations for the academy during his visit in the UK last year. Recruitment of players and coaches are reportedly underway, and a wide range of year-round programs are planned to begin in September. In the African Champions League, Egyptian giants Al Ahly overwhelmed at Labara of South Sudan 9-0 on Friday. Ahly won the preliminary tie 13-0 overall to match the record achieved by young Africans of Tanzania 10 years ago. Ahly played both legs in Alexandria because the national stadium in South Sudan's capital Juba is being renovated. Elsewhere, Côte d'Or became the first club from Seychelles to win a Champions League tie since 2004 when they drew 1-1 at home against Fomboni of Comoros. Côte d'Or advanced on away goals, having drawn 2-2 in the Comoros 2 weeks ago, and could face 2016 champions Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa in the round of 32. Sundowns host AS Otoho of Congo Brazzaville in Pretoria on Saturday, having lost the first leg 2-1 in Central Africa. In Uganda, late goals from Mustafa Kiza and Alan Okello gave hosts Kampala City Authority, KCCA, a 2-0 win over African Stars of Namibia and a passage to the next round. Stars had won the first leg 3-2 in Windhoek. And in boxing, Sergey Kovalev survived an eighth round scare to knock out Britain's Anthony Yarde and defend his WBO World Light Heavyweight title in a thrilling fight. Russia's Kovalev, who is 36, dominated earlier on in his home city of Chelyabinsk, but was close to being beaten in the eighth round. But despite being fatigued himself, Kovalev pounced on a tiring Yarde to land an 11th round knockout. Meanwhile, unified world heavyweight champion Andy Ruiz has confirmed he will contest a rematch against Anthony Joshua in Saudi Arabia. US-born Mexican Ruiz, who is 29, shocked Britain's Joshua in New York in June to win the WBA, IBF, WBO, and IBO world titles. They are set to meet again in the Middle East on December 7th. And in athletics, American Noah Lyles has set a meet record of 19.65 seconds to win the 200 meters with ease at Saturday's Diamond League meet in Paris. The previous record of 19.73 seconds belonged to Usain Bolt. And in the Kenyan Championships, a three-time World Half Marathon champion Geoffrey Kamworor and 2015 World Cross Country champion Agnes Tirop won the 10,000 meter titles at Nairobi's Nyayo Stadium on Wednesday. The victories mean that Kamworor and Tirop, along with other athletes who finished in the top three, booked their places on the Kenyan team for the IAAF World Athletics Championships in Doha 29 as the race doubled as an official national trial. Kenya's trials for all other disciplines will be held on September 12th to 13th. In one of the most competitive national trial races ahead of the World Championships, Kamworor lined up against the likes of World Under 20 champion and world leader Phoenix Kipruto, Olympic silver medalist Paul Tanui, World Under 20 5,000 meter silver medalist Stanley Waithaka, 2016 World Under 20 champion Rogers Kwemoi, and 2008 Olympic 5,000 meters bronze medalist Edwin Soy. Despite the tough lineup, Kamworor sprinted away from Kipruto in the closing stages to win in 27:24.16. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline, Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. You're hearing from Yemi Alade with Home. Mr. Dutch featuring Lava Lava will come your way with Just Like That. And then Chidinma Falling in Love will end our music for the day.
Just like that. kakafunga shakibinda anatamanisha mgongo wa kipinda wenipe vyote vya ndani changanye ubongo viuno vya bara na pwani lomboro kongo ai Selina oh Selina nipe za kichina china oh Selina ai Selina oh Selina nyonga unavyo imimina oh Selina.
Oh yeah, change them for me. If you change them for me, I go change them for you. If you get this start to throw away, ah, just like that. Cause I go they like to throw away, ah, just like that. Baby, give me one more tira, just like that. Touch me one more tira, just like that. Mmm, China, Ijama, come let's rap together. Yeah, give me bomb bomb.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Many African intellectuals and academics in particular consider it arrogant and in itself reckless that a number of European powers met in Berlin in 1885 to consider the partition of the African continent without any representative of the African people. The result of that conference showed clearly the ignorance of the ethnic and tribal continuity on the continent. It seemed that their main concern was the wealth of the African continent. But sadly, this is not only the fate of the African people. The Middle East people, or what the Asians call West Asia, are still suffering from what two European diplomats did in 1916. As the First World War was drawing to a close, and it appeared that the Ottoman Empire would end up in the losing side, these European diplomats met to deal with the spoils of war. In the several meetings back and forth, they finally reached an agreement to partition Middle East and have areas of operation, and it became known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916. This secret agreement would have been unknown to the entire world, but for the fact that the Tsarist Russia got wind of it and made claims that they too must participate in the spoils of war. And because they gave them part of the Ottoman Empire, they became custodians of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And also thanks to the revolution in Russia, the Russian Revolution in November 1917, the Communist Party in St. Petersburg released a number of secret agreements that have been signed by Tsarist Russia around the world. Among them was the Sykes-Picot Agreement. As I mentioned, this agreement is still having an impact today in the Middle East. And when the Versailles Conference convened at the end of the First World War, the release of the secret documents by the communist government in St. Petersburg was so shocking that the Versailles Treaty incorporated in the League of Nations the principle of open covenant openly arrived at. Sadly also, this principle is now more honored in the breach than in the observance, but it has also been passed on to the United Nations. The African states realized this violation at the time of the Congo crisis 1960-1964, particularly as it relates to the secession of Katanga and the death of Lumumba. And this motivated the African leaders to create the Organization of African Unity in 1963. And one of the things they pronounced then was that African problems should be solved by Africans themselves. And indeed, in the first years of the OAU, a number of African problems were solved by the OAU. And at the time also when they were saying that Africans would be embroiled in wars, territorial wars, the African Summit in Cairo in 1964 called on all African states to accept the territorial boundaries passed on to them by the colonial power, even though they know that these boundaries were not the best in terms of ethnic and tribal conciliations. These things are important because we are now seeing that this tendency of outsiders to want to solve problems in Africa without consulting is still going on. If you look at Libya, it is very strange that those who caused the turmoil in Libya in the first place because they wanted the regime change are now aligned against each other to see who would have the best advantage. And they are now talking about holding peace talks. But no one is talking to the African Union to see what contribution that they could make. And these go across the board. But there are still many Africans, too, who do not know the history of all this situation. And when there is a crisis in Africa, their first tendency is to look to Europe to solve their problems. They want Europe to get involved. One wonders why. But if they don't learn from history, then they will find themselves engulfed in more crisis. In Egypt in particular, when President Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Pan-Africanist and Pan-Arab president, when he stated that his foreign policy will be guided by the fact that all negotiations should be under the United Nations, he knew what he was talking about. Who he was followed by Sadat, who deviated from that policy and played a different card. Although he was able to retrieve the desert, we are still seeing that no dent has been made in the original problem of the Palestinian issue. So African leaders and African politicians should know that the ancestors and the leaders of Africa knew what they were doing. They called on African states not to allow any foreign bases on their territory. They knew what they were doing. Many African leaders today, they want foreign bases on their territory. So this is a lesson that we should learn. And what we are seeing today about Sykes-Picot is something Africans should learn and draw the appropriate lessons from. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa